Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Tense talks. President Biden holds a virtual meeting with Vladimir Putin amid rising fears over a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine. Then, investigating the insurrection. The inquiry into the January 6th attack on the Capitol intensifies as more Trump officials refuse to cooperate. And a history of discrimination. Many black farmers still struggle to receive compensation after being excluded from federal government agriculture programs.
We weren't able to pass on wealth. We weren't able to pass on a farm. And so to look at it and say, now your field is level, no.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden has put Russia's President Vladimir Putin on notice tonight that the U.S. will impose strong new sanctions if Russia invades Ukraine. The two men held a two-hour virtual summit today. It came as Russian troops have been building up along the Ukrainian border. We'll focus on that high-stakes meeting right after the news summary. China issued its own warning today that the U.S. will, quote, pay a price for a diplomatic boycott of the Winter Olympics in Beijing. The Chinese gave no specifics, but they said the move violates the Olympic spirit and that there could be fallout.
The United States should stop bringing politics into sports and stop interfering in the Beijing Winter Olympics with hurtful words and actions. Otherwise, it could harm a series of important bilateral dialogues and cooperation for international and regional issues.
Under the boycott, U.S. officials will not attend the games in February, but American athletes will still compete. There is word that French authorities have arrested one of the suspected killers of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi. News accounts today say that a former member of the Saudi Royal Guard was detained at an airport near Paris. It is believed that Khashoggi was murdered at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey in 2018. The U.S. House of Representatives moved this evening to clear the way for raising the national debt ceiling. The legislation provides for a simple majority vote in the evenly divided Senate on raising the government's borrowing limit. Senate leaders in both parties agreed on the need to act to prevent a national default.
We want a simple majority without a convoluted, risky, lengthy process, and it looks like the Republicans will help us facilitate that. So we feel very good about where we're headed on debt ceiling. It's not done till it's done, but the idea of letting Democrats carry it ourselves is what we've always said.
I believe we've reached here a solution to the debt ceiling issue that's consistent with Republican views of raising the debt ceiling for this amount at this particular time and allows the Democrats to proudly own it, which they're happy to do.
And we'll get more of the details on this later in the program. Former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows has reversed himself and now says that he will not give testimony about the U.S. Capitol assault last January. His attorney complains that a congressional panel wants to ask about matters covered by Mr. Trump's claim of executive privilege. Hawaii is under a state of emergency as a major storm stalls over the islands, dumping more than a foot of rain. The rain has poured down cliffs onto highways, and 50-mile-an-hour winds knocked down power lines. Still, Pearl Harbor today marked the 80th anniversary of the Japanese attack that brought the U.S. into World War II. About 30 elderly survivors attended. Rohingya refugees from Myanmar are suing Facebook's parent company, Meta, for more than $150 billion. The suit was filed in California. It alleges that posts on Facebook incited violence against the Muslim Rohingyas in mostly Buddhist Myanmar. A major outage at Amazon Web Services disrupted access to a number of sites today. The problem was mainly focused on cloud computing services in the eastern U.S. It affected everything from Delta Airlines and Netflix to the Associated Press. Workers at Kellogg's cereal plants have rejected a five-year contract. That announcement today means a two-month strike continues. The company says that it will now hire permanent replacement workers. On Wall Street, stocks surged again, led by tech companies. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 492 points to close at 35,719. The NASDAQ rose 461 points, 3%. The S&P 500 jumped 2%. And the U.S. formally returned a 3,500-year-old clay tablet to Iraq today after it and thousands of other antiquities were looted during the 1991 Gulf War. It bears part of the Epic of Gilgamesh from the ancient Sumerian civilization. The artifact was put on display in Baghdad at the Foreign Ministry, along with many other returned treasures. Still to come on the NewsHour, a Hawaii military community seeks answers on how its water was contaminated with petroleum. A new film details the detention and torture of an alleged Al-Qaeda mastermind, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
President Biden's meeting today via video conference with Russia's President Vladimir Putin was the fourth time the leaders have spoken or met this year. Russia now has more than 100,000 troops stationed on the border of Ukraine, and Mr. Biden gave Putin a, quote, crystal clear message. That is according to White House aides, that Russia faces significant economic reprisals if it were to invade. Here's Nick Schifrin.
Good to see you again.
In a virtual meeting over a real-life standoff, Presidents Biden and Putin started with smiles. But at the White House, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Biden delivered a firm warning.
There was no finger-wagging, but the president was crystal clear about where the United States stands on all of these issues.
Senior congressional officials tell PBS NewsHour the administration is threatening economic sanctions, including removing Russia from the international SWIFT banking system, freezing Russian banks' international assets, and blocking their international transactions. The U.S. Today also hinted any Russian invasion could threaten Russia's Nord Stream 2 pipeline, designed to deliver natural gas to Europe. Ukraine's military today is stronger than it was the last time it faced Russian invasion in 2014. Biden today told Putin the U.S. would increase military support to Ukraine, just as Ukraine recently deployed hundreds of American-made Javelin missiles and Turkish-made drones that can target Russian tanks. And the administration also said President Biden told Putin that NATO's eastern allies would receive more U.S. troops and training, similar to these 2016 exercises. For weeks, Russian military drills and irregular deployments signaled they're ready for escalation. Satellite images show a massive buildup along the Russian-Ukrainian border. And U.S. intelligence produced a map that shows five newly deployed Russian battalion tactical groups north of Ukraine, two newly deployed groups off Ukraine's northeast border, more troops off Ukraine's southeast, where Russia has invaded in the past, and additional tanks and artillery in Russian-annexed Crimea for a potential of 175,000 forces. And inside eastern Ukraine, Russian-backed separatists maintain control of territory and vow to fight from World War I-style trenches. In the Ukrainian military's trenches, this week President Volodymyr Zelensky tried to reassure frontline troops he has their backs. On Monday, as Armed Forces Day, Zelensky said the country faced an existential threat from a single enemy.
Freedom is the greatest value for us. It is a symbol of our country. All of Ukraine, the servicemen of the Armed Forces of Ukraine who continue to fill the most important mission, to defend the freedom and sovereignty of the state from the Russian aggressor.
The Kremlin said today Putin demanded, quote, legally fixed guarantees that Ukraine never host U.S. missiles or join NATO, as he said recently.
Just look how close to Russian borders is the military infrastructure of the North Atlantic Alliance. We take it more than seriously.
But today, Sullivan said Biden rejects that request.
He made no such commitments or concessions. He stands by the proposition the country should be able to freely choose who they associate with.
To deter Russia, Biden last night and today called his counterparts in the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and Italy to present a united front. Olaf Scholz will be Germany's chancellor as of tomorrow.
Just like everyone else in Europe and in the United States, we are worried about the troop movements we are seeing on the border with Ukraine, which is why it must be absolutely clear that it would be an unacceptable situation if Ukraine was threatened.
For more on all this, we turn to Victoria Nuland, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. She joins me from Capitol Hill, where she was testifying today. Victoria Nuland, welcome back to the NewsHour. Let's start by talking about the path to diplomacy that President Biden laid out today. What is the off-ramp that President Putin was offered?
Well, Nick, as you recall, with regard to Russia's invasion of eastern Ukraine, there is a set of agreements on the table for de-escalation called the Minsk Agreements, which essentially involves giving a special status for Donbas, having elections out there in exchange for Russia pulling out all of its forces and returning the sovereign border to Ukraine. So those talks, which were pretty active in 15 and 16, have gone stale. So the U.S. is offering to play a diplomatic role in getting those reinvigorated. President Putin also has a number of concerns that he likes to voice about the actions of NATO being destabilizing to Russia. We're obviously prepared, as the president said to President Putin and as National Security Advisor Sullivan has said publicly, to have a conversation with Russia along with our allies and partners about any strategic concerns that they have. But that's a different matter than whether Russia gets a veto over Ukraine's future, which it does not.
All right, so let's talk about the first aspect of that. The Minsk agreement signed in 2015 and 2014, as you said, calls on Kyiv to allow occupied territory, Donetsk and Luhansk, some degree of autonomy. Kyiv has resisted that. So are you saying that you will push Kyiv actually to follow through on those promises it's made?
Again, these were agreements that were entered into by both Ukraine and Russia under the auspices of France and Germany, and they call for Donbas to be deoccupied, for all of the foreign forces and mercenaries to come out, and for Russia to return control of the border, and in the process for Ukraine to grant more self-governance to Donbas. Now, since then, Ukraine has offered a high degree of self-governance to all of its other provinces. So Donbas would, in effect, have to catch up, and there could conceivably be some additional things, but those would have to be subject to negotiation, and it would be Kyiv's sovereign decision what level of special status to offer for Donbas.
And on NATO, which you referred to, why not consider preventing Ukraine from joining NATO, since there is no momentum right now for Ukraine to gain membership?
Well, first of all, the NATO charter signed in 1949 says that the alliance is open to any European democracy that can meet the standards of membership. Frankly, that would be an option for Russia, too, if it were to change manifestly, which it has not expressed an interest in doing. But we are not going to change NATO's open-door policy or more than 70 years of policy. And we are not going to give Russia a veto over the alliances of a sovereign country. Those are decisions for Ukraine to make and for NATO to make, not for the Kremlin to make.
Are you willing to provide any guarantees or assurances that U.S. missiles won't be based on Ukraine, as the Kremlin is asking?
You know, in 1998 and again in 2003, in the context of NATO negotiating its partnership agreement with Russia and then renewing it again, NATO made certain assurances that we would not station substantial combat forces along Russia's borders. NATO has lived up to those agreements. I can't say that Russia has lived up to its side of the agreements, but that would obviously continue to pertain as long as Russia was prepared to honor its side of the pact.
We've talked about carrots. Let's talk about the sticks. How specific did President Biden get today in threatening further actions such as removing Russia from the SWIFT banking system, freezing Russian banks' assets, and blocking Russian banks' access to international markets?
The president was crystal clear about what Russia and the Kremlin will confront if they move aggressively on Ukraine again, and about the impact on the Russian economy and on its status in the global economic system.
Another one of the sticks. You said today that Germany is prepared to, quote, suspend Nord Stream 2 in the event of an invasion. Has the incoming German government made that commitment? And do you think President Putin considers that important enough to be part of his calculus when it comes to what he does with Russian forces into Ukraine?
It is very hard to imagine that in the context of Russia moving aggressively on Ukraine, that Europe would want to increase its dependency on Russian energy.
Are you considering targeting President Putin's personal assets and or his most senior advisors?
I'm not going to get into specifics here or negotiate this in public, Nick, but we have not been shy in the past about our sanctions with regard to folks close to President Putin and to things that matter to him.
On bolstering Ukraine's military, I've spoken to senior Republican officials who say the administration isn't moving fast enough, specifically on the delivery of weapons. So do you believe that you need to send more and do so more quickly?
So this year alone, the United States has provided more than $450 million in security assistance to Ukraine. And we are obviously open to doing more if the situation requires.
And does that mean that the administration is committed to increasing the speed with which those defensive weapons would be delivered?
Again, there are a number of things already delivered to Ukraine that they need to be thinking about how to use in the context of self-defense. And we are talking to them about that, and we are open to other things that they may need.
And finally today, you said this. You said, this is a moment of testing. Autocrats and our friends will watch closely what we do. Why is this moment so important?
Because President Putin may be aspiring once again to change global geography by force, to violate the sovereignty of independent territory of an independent nation. And if the democracies stand by and allow that to happen, then it will embolden autocrats everywhere.
Tori Newland, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick.
The clock has been ticking on the next potential fiscal crisis for the U.S. government. The nation's debt ceiling could be reached, and government might not have the funds to pay its bill as soon as next week. But as we reported today, a breakthrough between Republicans and Democrats means they may have found a way out. For more on this, I'm joined by our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins. Lisa, here we go again. For a long time, for the last many months, there was a lot of bitter division over this issue of the debt ceiling. What's happened?
This was the problem a lot of us on Capitol Hill were the most worried about. I'm going to take you through what's happened today, and I want to start first with the policy. Let me explain. It's an unusual solution that our leaders have come up with today. Here's what they want to do. First, they want to craft a bill that would combine a few things. It would include a block on Medicare cuts that would automatically happen without congressional action. And with that, it would also create almost a new rule allowing for a simple majority in the Senate to pass a debt increase. That bill is now in the House. What would happen next is that path-clearing bill, as I call it, would need to get 60 votes in the Senate. We expect that to happen this week. That would then free up the ability of the Senate to pass a debt increase with a simple majority vote. And it would be a political way of saving face for everyone, especially Senate Minority Leader, the Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who you remember well, said, Democrats will have to do this on their own. We will not help them raise the debt ceiling. And he did, however, say he wanted them to do this through a process called reconciliation. You know, Democrats say it's a complete reversal on his part. It's at least a five-point turn. But clearly, the politics were in Democrats' side. They stuck it out together on this. Then Chuck Schumer had his first stare down with Senator McConnell over this, and he's pulled out a win. Now, I want to also talk a little bit about how this actually came about, because you and I have talked so many nights about all of the gridlock, 50-50 Senate, very difficult to get anything done. Simple. Sit down between Senators McConnell and Schumer day after day after day, didn't leak it. They talked to each other. And I think Senator Schumer sensed that Senator McConnell had kind of boxed himself in. Now, Senator McConnell still has a political problem. There are Republicans I talked to who are very unhappy with this. They wanted more of a showdown. They think the debt ceiling was one of their few pieces of leverage that they could have used to maybe have spending caps or make a bigger statement. They think this was a mistake. But now Senator McConnell has to get 10 Republicans to vote with him to clear the path for this debt ceiling. We'll watch that closely. It feels likely he will get those votes. I expect him to be one of them.
Very, very interesting what is taking place. Again, the ice seems to be cracking.
That's right. For now, our lawmakers are speaking with each other about important things. That is good.
Lisa Desjardins, thank you once again.
You're welcome.
Also at the Capitol, new headwinds for the Select Committee in the House of Representatives charged with investigating January 6th. It has been 11 months since the attack on the Capitol, and since then, the House committee has issued more than 40 subpoenas. A number of those subpoenas are aimed at former Trump administration officials and allies. And today, we got new details about who is cooperating and who is fighting back. Josh Gerstein joins me now to bring us up to speed. He is the senior legal affairs reporter for Politico. Josh Gerstein, thank you very much for being with us again. I think the main information we got today has to do with Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff to former President Trump. After initially saying he wouldn't cooperate, then last week he said he would. Now, again, he is saying he will not cooperate, not in a live interview. What's the significance of this?
Well, it's definitely a setback for the committee because the fact that Meadows had agreed to cooperate, at least partially cooperate, served as a signal for people down the line from the Trump White House and in the Trump orbit that maybe it would be okay to cooperate with the committee. There would be no terrible repercussions. But then really within a matter of days to have Meadows reverse himself and say he wouldn't testify, I think it's a problem for the committee because people are looking for signals. By indicting Steve Bannon for not cooperating, the committee was hoping to send a signal. And now they've got sort of, I think, a confusing set of messages going out to potential witnesses.
And what do you make of what his attorney is saying? Among other things, he's saying the committee doesn't appear to respect former President Trump's assertion of executive privilege. He's saying that the committee is asking for what he calls intensely personal communications.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how Meadows' lawyers could really be surprised by the fact that the committee doesn't respect President Trump, former President Trump's assertion of executive privilege. They've said as much and they've gone to court to essentially fight back against that privilege. So I'm not really surprised by that. I think what might have happened here is a change of heart on Meadows' part. You know, when he decided to cooperate, it was pretty clear that Trump was not happy with that decision. And then we had some conflict between them about Meadows' book that recently came out and some unflattering stories about President Trump that are in there, in particular, his handling of his COVID diagnosis during last year's political campaign season. So it wouldn't surprise me that Meadows has decided that, in fact, there's no way to cooperate with the committee and remain in Trump's good graces. And now he's sort of looking for a reason to do an about face.
Now, his attorney is saying that he may be prepared to sit down and or he may be prepared to answer questions in writing and potentially provide documents. He's already provided some. What does that mean? I mean, how different would it be if he's saying I'll answer some questions in writing versus doing it in person?
I mean, I think it would be very different, and I'd be surprised to see the committee take him up on that option. Generally, investigators like to have a live witness in front of them and to be able to go back and forth and do follow-up. What usually comes out if you have written questions is actually the person's attorney's response to the questions rather than the person themselves. And oftentimes, sort of all the detail and anything that might, in fact, be interesting is kind of ironed out of the statement before it makes it to the committee. So, like I said, I'd be surprised if they thought that that was an adequate substitute for having in-person live testimony.
Josh Gerstein, what do we know, if anything, about the documents that he has already turned over and what more the committee wants in the way of written records?
Well, it's a little bit unclear because, you know, the committee is trying to also get Trump White House records directly from the National Archives that has custody of those records. And in fact, one of the complaints that Meadows' lawyers has put forward about why they no longer think that he should be testifying is that there's been an effort to secure Meadows' phone records directly from telephone companies. There may have been efforts to secure people's email records or other forms of correspondence. And that's one of the explanations that they're giving for why they don't want to cooperate. I think they may be afraid that they could be surprised at a potential deposition by things that they haven't seen or haven't expected. So I'm curious about how that will eventually be resolved. I think that the simplest way would be for him to try not to testify. But of course, that risks criminal prosecution, just like Steve Bannon is currently being prosecuted.
And that is the committee's recourse. That is something they can do if they choose. We also received word today that the former Vice President Mike Pence's Chief of Staff, Mark Short, is saying that he will cooperate with a committee. And how do you read that?
Well, you know, Mark Short, I put in a somewhat different category from a lot of other Trump officials. He was already someone that had been critical of President Trump's response to the events on January 6th. He was someone that is seen more as being in Vice President Pence's camp. And so the fact that he would cooperate, I don't think is really going to be taken as a signal by other Trump allies that they should go one way or the other way. I view it as a fairly unique circumstance. And, you know, given Mark Short's track record and his position and his allegiances to Pence, I'm not surprised that he would step forward and say, I'll cooperate with the committee. In fact, he's told a lot of this story publicly already.
And of course, that's a reminder that Vice President Pence was the subject of much of what the mob that attacked the Capitol was there looking for. Josh Gerstein with Politico, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy. Take care.
For decades, black farmers have been excluded from federal farm programs, a systematic pattern of discrimination that the U.S. Department of Agriculture acknowledged decades ago. And yet, proposals to compensate farmers for past wrongs have languished in controversy and red tape. The most recent include the Biden administration's efforts to earmark such funds in its American Rescue Plan and now Build Back Better. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro begins his report in northwest Kansas as part of our ongoing series, Race Matters.
Well, got them papers I give you.
Walking down this dirt road brings Bernard Bates back to the highest and lowest points of his 84 years.
Mm-hmm. This land behind you goes back generations in your family.
Yes, mm-hmm. Clear back to slavery.
Dad was a good farmer. He was one of the best ones in Graham County.
Dating way back to the 40s, Carla Bates Adams says her father was a prolific producer here in Nicodemus, Kansas, a rare enclave of black farmers whose ancestors settled here after they were freed from slavery.
So there was more land that you owned, different chunks of land.
North of the cemetery, there's another 80 acres.
In the early 1980s, amid the historic agricultural recession and crop disasters that hit the Midwest, many farmers fell behind on their loan payments, including Bernard Bates.
Bugs, hail, wind and rain, freeze and everything for 3-4 years in a row.
When he approached the U.S. Department of Agriculture for relief, Carla Bates Adams says not for the first time he was treated differently.
We know that the white farmers were getting the assistance, and the black farmers were not.
They were getting all kinds of loans.
The Bates then witnessed and even photographed the dismantling of their livelihood in foreclosure.
That must have been very painful to witness.
Tell me about it.
They truly took, you know, our livelihood, you know, and then left, you know, my parents to have to go on food stamps.
Their land was subsequently sold off to white farmers.
The Bates farmstead is among millions of acres of land that black farmers have lost over the decades.
In the 1920s, 14% of all farmers in the United States were African American. That number is down to less than 1.5% today.
There are men like Bernard that would still be farming because that's what he loves and that's what he wanted to do.
Nicodemus resident Johnella Holmes is a retired professor and director of the Kansas Black Farmers Association. For decades, she says, they've been excluded from federal agriculture programs like price subsidies, disaster relief, and especially loans, the financial backbone of American agriculture.
Those loans are just pivotal. Equipment is so expensive anymore that one single farmer, especially the small farmers, they can't afford that equipment.
In 1999 and again in 2010, black farmers were offered limited compensation after a class action suit, but the settlement was marred by allegations of fraudulent claims on one hand and the exclusion of possibly thousands of legitimate claimants on the other. Bernard Bates was a plaintiff.
And I myself haven't got one dime. Not a dime.
The Biden administration has included several billion dollars in loan forgiveness and other relief for distressed and disadvantaged farmers in its Build Back Better plan.
We know for a fact that socially disadvantaged producers were discriminated against by the United States Department of Agriculture. We know this.
Earlier this year, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack unveiled a similar $4 billion relief plan specifically for minority farmers in the American Rescue Plan. That triggered several lawsuits on behalf of white farmers claiming reverse discrimination, and it succeeded in suspending the program pending the outcome of the litigation.
If a black farmer lived across the road and this bill went through, I see him get his mortgage paid off. It ticks me off, because that was money stolen from me, given to him.
John Stevens is a fifth-generation farmer in Pine County, Minnesota, and is a well-known advocate of the environmentally friendlier regenerative farming.
Do you think that discrimination exists today against black farmers?
As a federal system, I would say no. Now, when you go to your local office, sure. And that would go anyway, whether it's white to black to white. There's racist people all over this country.
What are these plaintiffs not understanding?
Oh, I think they understand. I think they just don't want to acknowledge the history.
Professor Holmes says that history of discrimination has taken an enormous toll on black farm families that's still felt today.
We weren't able to pass on wealth. We weren't able to pass on a farm. And so to look at it and say, now your field is level, no, Bernard Bates' family, they were denied the opportunity to continue to farm. That didn't level the field.
John Stevens says white farmers are as likely today to face rejection at the USDA or at a private lender. He says the key is to persevere.
I don't want to hear your victim story. So what if I discriminate against you on something? Is that going to stop you?
If you're the government, possibly. Or you're the banker.
Go to another bank. Postpone it a couple years. If you want to be a farmer, if you want to be anything, just pick your bootstraps up and forget the rest of the world and do what you need to do.
Well, I made my own straps and my own boots, and I'm pulling them up.
Angela Dawson farms just a few miles north of Stevens. 4 years ago, she moved here in a career switch back to a family tradition that ended when her grandfather lost his farm.
You have to have at least 1,000, maybe 2,000, 10,000 acres in order to really be a sustainable farmer, and that's something that I definitely didn't have access to.
So she tried to join the booming business of organic farming, whose humanely raised meat commands higher prices and is therefore feasible on a small farm. But when Dawson, who has a degree in business administration, presented her business plan with her loan application, she says the USDA agent was not convinced.
I was really enthusiastic about the pigs, and she said, what are you doing here?
What do you think they were really asking you?
I felt like they were asking me what makes me think I could do this.
Despite an appeal, her application was rejected in a process that took 18 months, she says. Agriculture Department officials declined to comment specifically on this case. Dawson found a new passion, as lucrative as it is controversial.
This one is a good one.
Hemp. The plant is now legal to grow in all states. Its extract sold for medicinal use.
My decision to go into hemp was driven by economics. For CBD hemp, the average farmer makes about $50,000 per acre.
Dawson's farm is now home base of a 33-member cooperative of minority-owned farms across the U.S.
This is the brain. This is the brain of the operation. Her name
the co-op
is
guides members growing hemp on how to monitor the crop so it meets licensing standards for medicinal cannabis.
We use regenerative practices, but we also use technology, and we don't want people to get into farming to be poor.
Business has been great, she says, but that raised a red flag at one local bank, which closed her accounts.
The bank said that they thought I could be trafficking. So the criminal image that's associated with hemp and black people is really difficult for me to overcome.
That's the rosin and the medicine.
So it's ever after, but we're still working on the happily part.
Is it something that you would like to get back?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Also waiting for happily ever after, the Bates family, hoping by legal action or reparation to buy back the land and legacy that they say was unjustly confiscated.
Bye.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro in Nicodemus, Kansas.
Fred's reporting is in partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. U.S. military families stationed in Hawaii and others working in and around the base there are dealing with tap water contaminated with petroleum. The cause is unknown, but investigators say a leak from a nearby fuel storage facility operated by the Navy may be to blame. On Monday, Secretary of the Navy Carlos Del Toro issued an apology. But as Stephanie Sy reports, there were warning signs.
For days, active duty soldiers at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam in Hawaii have been distributing water to their own. Thousands of military families without clean drinking water due to fuel contamination.
I am a single active duty mom to two special needs kids.
At several town halls in the last week, resident after resident reported harrowing medical problems in their children.
On Sunday, my children took a bath, and for 45 minutes afterwards, they complained of burning skin.
And in their pets.
When we made the heartbreaking choice to put my beloved dog down after a mysterious illness.
The Navy-run water system serves some 93,000 people. About 1,000 households reported smelling fuel in the water starting in late November. It took the Navy almost a week to acknowledge the problem. Residents like Audrey LaMagna had been smelling the fuel for days.
I decided, let me just fill up a cup, like a plastic cup full of water. And what do you know? The cup smelled like fuel.
LaMagna, a military spouse, has a baby and a seven-year-old.
What went through your mind when you tested the water and you realized you had been bathing your children in it and that there was signs of fuel in it?
I'm poisoning them and I didn't even know. Like, how sad is that?
The contamination was found in the Navy-run Red Hill Well, which sits close to an underground fuel storage facility built during World War II. The facilities had a history of leaks dating back to 1949, with 27,000 gallons of jet fuel accidentally released in 2014. Just 2 months ago, Hawaii's Department of Health fined the Navy $325,000 for violations at the facility, including failure to maintain corrosion protection of the metal tanks. The 20 tanks have the capacity to hold 250 million gallons of fuel, and they sit above the island's most important aquifer, which supplies groundwater to 20% of Honolulu residents. As a precaution, civilian water authorities shut down a shaft near Red Hill that serves customers in Honolulu. Governor David Ige issued an emergency order requesting the Navy come up with a plan to empty the fuel tanks, but it's unclear he has any enforcement authority. Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro apologized on Monday during a visit to the base and announced operations were suspended at Red Hill.
As long as I'm Secretary of the Navy, I pledge to you that we will address all the issues that you just mentioned with sincerity, transparency, with a complete dedication to try to fix this problem.
For now, many families are finding alternate housing, including Audrey LaMagna's. They've moved to a hotel, which the Navy says they'll pay for later.
Does that work for you?
No, it does not, because we live paycheck to paycheck. We're on a single income.
The Navy says it is flushing clean water through its system, which can take up to 10 days.
Even if they were to give us the all clear, quite frankly, I don't trust what the Navy has to say anymore.
Joining me now to discuss the wider implications of the water contamination is the manager and chief engineer of Honolulu's Water Supply Board, Ernest Lau. Mr. Lau, aloha, and thank you for joining the NewsHour. When did the Navy notify you about the contamination at the Red Hill shaft, and what was your reaction?
Stephanie, actually, the Navy did not notify us about the drinking water contamination. Our State Department of Health notified us on Sunday evening. That was a Sunday after Thanksgiving. But we actually got no official notification from the Navy.
You shut down the Halawa shaft, which serves 20% of Honolulu's water customers. Why did you do that? Did you find contamination in water in that well?
Just to be clear, Stephanie, we have not found contamination by fuel in our drinking water in Halawa shaft. Halawa shaft represents 20% of our supply capacity. So we took that precaution of shutting it down because we saw what was happening to the Navy. From their drinking water source at Red Hill shaft, they actually ended up pumping fuel into their water system and delivering it to their customers. So as a precaution, and I do not want to put our water customers from the Board of Water Supply, the public, at risk by pumping fuel into their drinking water system. So we shut down the shaft before we detected any amounts of fuel in the water.
You have been looking at this issue, I understand, since 2014, Ernie, when there was a massive leak of 27,000 gallons of fuel from one of the tanks. Does it frustrate you that not more has been done to secure this water source?
We've been working for 8 years to ring the alarm bells that this facility needs to be addressed. It needs to be either upgraded to double wall tanks or completely removed. But for the last 8 years, our voices haven't been heard. We've urged the regulators, the Department of Health, and the US EPA and the Navy to take action to prevent a disaster that would impact heavily our drinking water resource.
The Navy has now stopped operations at the Red Hill fuel storage tanks, which is what you had been calling for. The Hawaii congressional delegation had been calling for that. Governor Ige has said he wants to see those tanks emptied of fuel. Is that satisfactory to you?
This gives us hope that suddenly the key decision makers are voicing their concerns about the facility. What remains, though, Stephanie, is actual implementation. Are they going to carry through, or is the emergency order issued by the health director for the state of Hawaii going to be enforced strictly and hold the Navy accountable? We've seen in the past letters, strongly worded letters sent from our Department of Health and EPA to the Navy, but we haven't really seen the follow-through and those regulators holding the Navy accountable. So now is the time to not do that anymore. We really need to get this thing addressed right away as soon as possible. And for the Board of Water Supply, immediate removal of the fuel out of Red Hill is the only real way to reduce this risk, massive risk to our drinking water aquifer. The Navy is experiencing it firsthand right now. And that's very unfortunate. I feel so terrible for their customers having to endure this and, drink the fuel contaminated water. I do not want that to be repeated with the general public, the almost over 400,000 people that we serve water in the city of Honolulu itself. We cannot let that happen. So I need the regulators to hold the Navy accountable. I need the Navy to step forward and not fight us anymore. We've been fighting with them for 8 years to do the right thing to protect the water resource. We've always said to them, you also depend on the resource itself for Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam. And they've told us that Red Hill Shaft supplies 24% of their supply for their base. So now, unfortunately, we see firsthand how important clean drinking water is to our community and to the base itself.
Ernest Lau, Chief Engineer with Honolulu's Water Supply Board, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour.
Mahalo.
A new HBO documentary that debuted this week tells the story of a man once thought to be a top Al-Qaeda operative and of U.S. attempts to justify torture in the name of protecting Americans. Amna Nawaz recently sat down with the filmmaker Alex Gibney. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Abu Zubaydah was the first high-value detainee subjected to the CIA's program of enhanced interrogation techniques, practices denounced as torture both here in the U.S. and around the world. After being captured in a firefight in Pakistan in 2002, Zubaydah was shuttled among so-called black sites, which are secret prisons run by the CIA all over the world. He has never been charged with a crime, but for the past 20 years has remained imprisoned, mostly at Guantanamo Bay, while a team of lawyers fights for his release. A new HBO documentary called The Forever Prisoner explores the story of Abu Zubaydah and U.S. actions in the name of national security. The filmmaker behind it is Academy Award winner Alex Gibney, and he joins me now. Welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Abu Zubaydah is considered a high-value detainee to the U.S. Tell us a little bit about him. What did the U.S. believe that he knew that made him high-value?
Well, certain members of the CIA believed that he was the number three in Al-Qaeda. That made him a high-value detainee. Other members of the CIA actually felt he was more of a kind of independent facilitator, which is actually what he was. He was flown to a secret site, which we now know was in Thailand, northern Thailand, and he was interrogated, at first by FBI agents, and then later by a group from the CIA, ultimately by a gentleman named James Mitchell.
When the FBI is leading the questioning, is he offering them any information that's helpful?
He offered the FBI information that was helpful almost immediately, and it was about an impending attack, in this case, is on Israel, funded by people in Saudi Arabia, and the CIA was able to prevent that attack. So immediately, he was offering valuable, actionable intelligence through traditional rapport-building techniques, which had nothing to do with torture.
Then the CIA remains convinced he's withholding information. We don't exactly understand why, but they decide to ramp up the pressure. This man that you mentioned, James Mitchell, becomes much more central to this operation. I just want to play a quick clip here. Here is how you introduce him in the film.
Mitchell was the inventor of EITs, the acronym for what the CIA called enhanced interrogation techniques, and what the rest of the world called torture.
If my boss tells me it's legal, especially if the president has approved it, I'm not going to get into the nuances about what some guy in the basement or what some journalist thinks about it, because they're free to trade places with me anytime they think they can do a better job of protecting Americans.
Alex, how does that man, how does James Mitchell end up at the black site run by the CIA where Abu Zubaydah is being interrogated? What's his background in interrogations?
That's a really good question. He had absolutely zero background in interrogation. None. He had never interrogated anybody in his life. However, he did have a distinguished career as a psychologist who had been spending time at the so-called Air Force SEER School. SEER stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. So he had observed and was part of a school to learn people, to teach people how to resist torture, but he had never himself done any interrogations.
Despite this, Mitchell submits a list to the CIA. These are suggested techniques that they should be considering. That list includes things like slapping detainees, walling, which is basically shoving them up against a wall, stress positions, cramped confinement, sleep deprivation, waterboarding. To most of us, layman, it sounds like torture, but of course the U.S. is a signatory to the Geneva Convention against torture. DOJ signs off on all of this. How does that happen?
Well, that's part of the story of the forever prisoner. It happens through a kind of excruciating legal exercise in which they use the rationale or the rationalization that because we do these things to our own people, how bad could it actually be? Because indeed, we do waterboard some of our soldiers to show them what might be in store for them if they're captured by a terrible regime. But those are exercises. Furthermore, these techniques almost always result not in people telling you what is the truth, but they tell you exactly what it is that they think you want to hear.
So the Department of Justice essentially gives the green light to James Mitchell and a team of CIA interrogators who are holding Abu Zubaydah. What happens next? What does that mean for his interrogations?
It means that they engage in these techniques, including waterboarding. And he's waterboarded 83 times in the course of a few weeks. And indeed, at one point, he dies. He literally stops breathing. He has to be revived, brought back. And at one point, James Mitchell, who, after all, was kind of the architect of these techniques, even appeals to the CIA and says, you know, we've waterboarded him consistently, and he's undergone enormous pain. We don't think that it's worth doing it anymore. And the CIA insists that he continue. And they continue to waterboard him over and over and over again.
You know, people will look at this story. They will have followed the news over the last 20 years, too, known about these techniques, and say, in times of war, in the name of national security, the U.S. has always and probably will always do ugly and horrific things. What would you say to them?
I would say two things. Number one, these techniques are immoral. I would say, number two, they do not yield the truth. They're undependable. They tend to yield what the interrogators want to hear. The CIA thought he was the number three in Al-Qaeda, which he wasn't. But ultimately, he says, yes, I'm the number three in Al-Qaeda. So you'd have to ask yourself, if you're in the intelligence business, what do you want, the truth or somebody to tell you what you want to hear?
Meanwhile, the man at the center of all of this, Abu Zubaydah, we do not hear from. What does the future hold for him?
That's a good question. He is in Guantanamo. He's never been charged with a crime. He's never been permitted to challenge his detention. And one of the things we discovered as part of doing this documentary was a cable, or a series of cables back and forth from the black side in Thailand to the CIA in Langley. And the CIA assures the people who are doing the interrogation, who are afraid that Abu Zubaydah may someday tell what happened to him, rest assured, and this is a direct quote, he will remain incommunicado for the remainder of his life. And so far, that's been the case, though interestingly, his name has recently surfaced in the Supreme Court. And a certain number of justices wondered, how is it possible that somebody could be held for 20 years without the ability to challenge their detention?
The documentary is The Forever Prisoner. It debuts on HBO and HBO Max. Alex Gibney, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And a news update before we go. Australian government officials will not attend the Winter Olympic Games in Beijing, joining a U.S. diplomatic boycott announced earlier this week. Australia's prime minister says that China has not responded to his country's concerns over alleged human rights abuses. Like American athletes, Australian athletes will still compete in the games. On the NewsHour online right now, watch the U.S. Navy's full commemoration ceremony marking the 80th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack. The Secretary of the Navy gave a keynote address at the remembrance in Hawaii. And separately, President Biden observed the anniversary by visiting the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. You can see all of the day's events at pbs.org/newshour. 80 years. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.